Welcome to the Stinging Fly podcast. My name is Nicole Flattery. The Stinging Fly has been publishing new writers and new writing for the past 27 years. We take a particular interest in promoting the short story, and for this podcast, we ask writers from the latest issue of the Stinging Fly magazine to join us in the studio and discuss their work. On this month's episode, I'm joined by writer Audrin Waldron. He is a writer and hurler from Freshford, County Kilkenny, living in Belfast. His work has appeared in Sonder and The Stinging Fly and is forthcoming from The Pig's Back. He hurls for Lough Yerrig, CLG, excuse my Irish, which is poor, Temporary, from which he'll be reading today, is his first story published by The Stinging Fly. Welcome.
Thank you, Nicole.
Would you like to read from your story for us?
Yeah, no problem. So I'm just going to read from the start.
Lovely, thanks so much.
Push notification as soon as she wakes up. Grey rectangle on her screen, a WhatsApp. Dalston, the message says, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Details upon acceptance. Makeup skills required. Respond Y now if interested. She responds Y, rolls from bed and showers. Water lukewarm, pipes freckled with the brown of rust, slicks her hair behind her ears and drenches it. Gets to the phone once it lights up, water still dripping from her hair. Job confirmed, it says, along with an address. White shirt, dark skirt. Enter through back door. Ask for Samantha on arrival. All equipment provided, 9 a.m. sharp. She has time, she takes it, ruminates over porridge bubbling thick in a pot that is turning from black to grey with age, wears a t-shirt to avoid staining work clothes, nibbles into a hangnail on the edge of her thumb. Porridge off the boil, eats it undecorated. At 10 to 8 she catches her hair back behind her head into a ponytail and pins the rolled up sleeves just beneath her elbows. She moisturises, the skin stretched and thin like dough rolled to within an inch of its life left to hang across her bones. She fills an empty plastic bottle with water and gets moving. A corner shop front bleached white and stripped of all character. A makeshift runway visible through the two floor-to-ceiling display windows that flank the front door, fold-out chairs surrounding it on either side. Above the black awning that tops the door is a sign where the outline of the previous shop name remains in ghost form, painted over. Through the windows, people readying the staging area, the type expected when the text read Dalston, fashionable, youngish, but old enough to be trusted to run an event, wearing clothes that fit in a way that makes her question everything she knows about fashion. Enters through a back door in the alley behind the building at 9:01. On arrival, she is pointed in the direction of Samantha, a short woman looking into a phone and poking its screen. Samantha looks to be about 3 years younger than her and is also wearing a white shirt and black skirt, although her skirt has a white paint splatter effect. Name? Samantha asks. Aoife Devaney, she says. Oh yes, lovely, Samantha says. Aoife, you must be Irish, are you? I am, yeah. My mum is Irish. Her name is Rianach. She probably has a worse time here than you. Probably, Aoife chuckles awkwardly. Right, Aoife, Samantha says. If you saw the front, it's a bit of a pop-up fashion show. A ton of exciting, small, local labels all exhibiting. So it's going to be in and out all day. You'll be on foundation. Nothing complicated, just a light touch as our own artists will be doing eyes and lips. You just need to keep the pace up. A few touches on the model, then move them on. Got it. A room with three chairs and two girls standing beside two of them. She stands beside the third and is handed a palette, an angle brush, a powder brush and a sponge. Samantha comes back into the room leading a model by the hand and sits her down into the chair beside Aoife. Samantha asks Aoife for the equipment in her hands. Right, ladies, she says. What we are going for today is a natural look. The eyebrows will be done by the time the models reach you so you can start with the foundations applied and the angle brush in underneath the brow. Be sure to blend. I can't stress the importance of the blend enough. She performs the actions as she speaks, next lifting the sponge. Even it out, even it out. Your job is all about the blend and the speed. Sponge on the cheeks and the forehead, then the angle brush again. Top it off with a dusting of the bronzer in your palette. It is exactly how it was in the video tutorial Aoife watched on the tube. She has put makeup on her own face before but has never had to do so for somebody else and worries about the weight of her touch. They come in threes and they are as she imagined them. Otherworldly, perfectly round heads, long and thin legs. Hairstyles identical, middle parted black, gelled down in unerringly straight lines. Uniformly unblemished skin that makes Aoife want to peel her own and start again. The work progresses at the pace she likes, without time to speak or think. She flicks with the angle brush, pats with the sponge and dusts with the powder brush. The models revolve in and out. After an hour, she recognises the one at her fingertips as the first of the day, back again. A smile goes unreturned. Around what she assumes to be noon, she begins to feel fraught. She knows that she is dehydrated, having not taken a drink of water since her shift began. The skin of her arm stretches and resists as she continues to apply the makeup. Samantha re-enters and explains that breaks will operate on a one-by-one basis starting now. Samantha will fill in for whoever chooses to go first, and they will have exactly half an hour. There are lunch boxes in the kitchen towards the back of the building that are clearly marked for them, along with bottles of water. But of course, they are free to eat their own lunch if they have brought one. They are also free to watch the show from backstage or from the floor, or free to leave the building if they would like. No demands are placed on their breaks, Samantha says, other than that they return after exactly half an hour. So who's first? She asks. Aoife feels the strain between her dry knuckles and wants to say that she will go first, but keeps her mouth shut, and the girl third in line volunteers. Samantha takes her palette and tools and looks to her watch. Okay, she says, it's 12:03. Please be back by 12:33. The girl nods and scurries out the door. Aoife reaches to the far side of the model's face and worries that the overstretched patch of arid skin on the side of her torso will further deteriorate into a rash. The sun sits above the crook of a small hopper window towards the roof. It casts light into the already well-lit room and puts a glow on the face of Aoife's model. She angles her face as her jawline is blended. In the light, Aoife spots a small hollow beneath her lip to the left, the lingering trace of a piercing, an anchor to the real world in her celestial beauty, something that she has that says she has lived a life and not been specifically hatched for this moment. When it is 33 past the hour, the girl who first took lunch returns, and the middle girl's knee twitches outwards as soon as she spots her. Aoife continues to pat, brush, and flick. Her stare doesn't break from its straightforward line in the time it takes the twitching girl to take her lunch. She needs to be tapped on the shoulder when it has gotten to 3 minutes past one, and it is time for her to slide out of the room and begin her half hour. From the fridge in the kitchen at the back of the building, she grabs a sleek neon pink lunchbox with round corners marked with a label carrying her name. Inside, she finds a sandwich perfectly cut into triangles. It dominates the box widthwise, with a bottle of water doing the same lengthwise. In a cubby of space between the sandwich and the box's edges lie three individually cut green apple slices. She lifts the sandwich from the box. Chickpeas, avocado, lettuce, tomato, and mustard makes up its insides. Once she has eaten, she finds a corner near the front door, far enough behind the crowd that nobody is blocking her view. Watching the models is like seeing them on TV. They are so far away, so impenetrable that they may as well be on a broadcast. Aoife feels like not one of these girls has ever had a hangnail. She finishes the last of her water and wonders if any of them have ever moved an inch the wrong way. She returns at 31 minutes past one, hops on the balls of her feet to the bathroom, figuring this as her only chance for the day, and empties herself as quickly as possible. She is unsure if she has gotten it all, but the time on her phone slips to 33 and she knows she has to move. She washes her hands, cutting off the tap before the water has time to warm up. She crosses the threshold of the LED-lit makeup room at 34 minutes past and takes over from Samantha. The rest of the working day passes as the first half had. Somewhere near the end, she realizes that her mouth has been slightly agape since the return from lunch. At 4:45, she dots the sponge into the foundation and reaches out to her arm, doesn't find a face at the end of it. The other two girls look at Aoife. She realizes the room is empty, but for them, the music outside has stopped. Samantha enters 5 minutes later, again using her phone as a checklist, index finger prodding. "Very well done, girls," she says. "Happy to report no issues to the app. Full payments all around." Aoife thanks Samantha and leaves. On the tube home, she notices the foundation still on her fingertips, feels a weird tinge of pride at the working day's dust distorting her skin colour, blurring the lines of her fingerprints. She washes her hands when she gets home and boils the kettle, emptying it into a cup of instant noodles. She takes her cup into her bedroom to avoid the ever-changing cast of flatmates that amble within the common areas, asking for her full name in order to find her on LinkedIn, inquiring as to what it is she does. As she unspools noodles from her fork on her bed, Aoife checks her banking app. 2 jobs away from rent, with 4 working days left in the month. Not so bad, she thinks. Doable and probably a target that could be exceeded. She plans to read, but once the cup is emptied, the background tiredness begins to ripple to the surface of her brain, her skin sucked dry. She leans her head back on her pillow and her hair fans out beneath her.
Thank you so much. How do you find reading aloud?
It gets harder as you go along.
My God. Yeah.
I'm one of those people whose voice becomes extremely hoarse as they talk, which I find all the time on nights out and stuff, you know. You sit there trying to talk to someone and your voice just gets worse and worse. But
it won't stop you.
No, it'll never stop me. In either reading short story form or in talking to people in the pub form.
I do find that sometimes even if I read for 10 minutes, I feel like I've been reading for 2 hours. Like it's like time does not move in the same way.
Yeah, and it's that feeling as well where you're like, I can look at like the clock now and see that I have been reading for probably about 10 minutes, or maybe maybe even less. But it does feel like I just read for about 45 minutes.
You're a good reader. when you write something, when you're writing a story, do you ever read it aloud to yourself?
Yes, actually I do. I got into the habit of doing that because I think it was probably from university or whatever, where I did a journalism degree. And they would have often said to us, if you have the time, read it out loud to yourself because that's how you'll catch your mistakes. The best, just like copy editing. And I do still do that. But the problem that I have found, and I actually, as I was reading there, I noticed it a few times, is that I have a very particular, I suppose, accent and way of speaking in the sense that, like, I've been away from North Kilkenny for a long time, but I still very much speak like I'm from North Kilkenny. Yeah. And so I'll always say things like in underneath and stuff like that. Like I'll add in words that don't need to be there.
Yeah. I also do that.
Yeah. But I have tried and tried to put that into writing.
Yeah.
But I've just, every time whenever I go to edit them, I'm always like, no, that is actually making it less clear and stuff. Yeah, you know what you're saying? You know, it's in behind something, just say behind, you know, kind of thing, unless it's a character talking. But I really, as I was reading there, I did see that there was one where I did say in underneath as part of description. But I think it was an English character talking, and I was like,
I don't know.
They wouldn't say that. that's the thing, is that I have, I suppose that's one thing that I kind of try to deal with, where like, if you try to be like naturalistic in your reading, you end up sounding like yourself. But sometimes, you know, your characters aren't you. Well, most of the time your characters aren't you.
Yeah.
And so they don't, they're not supposed to speak like you. Like that girl in that story, Aoife,
isn't nothing like me.
It never specifies where she's from, but there's no hint that she's from Kilkenny or anything like that. Also, I never lived in London. So it's...
I was going to ask you.
Yeah, no, it's that kind of thing that... you don't want to do too much unless the characters are supposed to be people from where you're from.
Exactly, yeah. One thing I do find when I read my work aloud, which I'm almost like super self-conscious of doing in like your room or whatever, it just feels so strange and very formal, but you catch word repetition more than anything else.
Yeah.
Because there's always like... Every writer has words they use again. I know mine, like again and again. Like, and you're like, oh, I'm saying it.
Yeah. You catch, it's repetition and bad rhythm as well. Like if you start running out of breath while you're reading your sentence, you're like, all right, well, shorten that. Like, unless that's what you're going for, you know, unless you're going for some Pynchonian two-page sentence or whatever, you know, but like, it's that kind of thing. And yeah, you realize as well, I would have in original drafts and stuff, I would have the awful habit of over adjective use, but like throwing two and three in front of the one noun and stuff like that. And then you realize whenever you read that out that it's just totally redundant. Which, I mean, again, it's a good part of it. But the self-consciousness is funny. Whenever I wrote that story, I was living with my parents. And so, you know, you'd be like upstairs reading out loud to yourself and your parents are downstairs being like, What's going on up there? Like,
you know,
I could be doing worse things.
Exactly. <You know. laughs> I want to ask you. Well, firstly, I want to ask you how you wrote this story, but I also want to ask you about rhythm because the story has a great rhythm. But first, tell me about the process of writing this. And
So it was. It's kind of hard to remember a lot of it now because whenever this got accepted, say, by this thing in Fly, I was thinking to myself, I was like, I feel like I wrote that story ages ago. And I checked the metadata on it and I started the file in February 2020. And I actually think I wrote the first draft pretty quickly. But like, it's funny to think now that, like, as I was finishing that first draft, it was like COVID was starting, like, you know, which to me feels like, 5 years is long enough, but that feels like it was about 15 years ago.
I think it's the way time moves now. I feel like I can't even remember it.
No, exactly. Yeah, which is what I mean in part about, like, I find it hard to remember writing a lot of that. I do remember that it was a lot longer originally, which used to be a big problem of mine. I'm going to sit down and write a short story. Next thing, it's like 12,000 words long. But I just remember it's a universal feeling, like that feeling of... doing jobs and just being like, Jesus, what am I doing here? Like, and then I think at the time, right before COVID. If I remember right, there was a lot of stuff about gig workers in Dublin and in London, like a lot of protests about their rights and things like that. So I think that's why it was on my mind, this idea of a gig app, like a gig economy app, but it's not Deliveroo or Just Eat. It's for different, like menial jobs in otherwise, you know, professional, middle class, whatever you want to call it, professions. That, you know, that this character is, it doesn't really get into her background, but you can probably kind of guess from what she does and stuff like that, and the way she has that phone call with her mother that she's, you know, probably a young graduate from Dublin or anywhere in Ireland, but from one of the universities in Dublin or something, and that she's gone off to London, like very many of said people. Mm. But it's just not going right. Because at the time, yeah, there was that whole thing of like that kind of subterranean class of gig economy workers. Mm. And I think at the time I was probably thinking about, like, you know, this is coming for you. whether or not it'll be in that shape or whatever, you know, that this precarity is coming for you, that you can look at, you can say, God, isn't it awful that the Uber drivers or whoever don't get contracts or whatever. It's coming for us all, I think was my feeling at the time. Probably still is my feeling. And so that's what, so I sat down and just kind of made that story out of it. And then I left it alone for years. I just didn't feel that the original draft that I had done had hit on what I was kind of talking about there, that I didn't think I had it right. And I left it for ages. It's actually quite unlike most of the things that I write, even in terms of, like you were saying, about the rhythm and stuff. I usually try to do that kind of more naturalistic prose and stuff, whereas that one is more clipped and stuff. And I left it for ages, and then it was, I think, if I'm right in saying this now, my friend Chris Bozang published a novel in, I'm going to say, December 23. Mm. And in this novel, his character, as part of her dole, which is done through an app from the, whatever he calls it, the Department of Social Protection in the book, has to go into an office and shred a bunch of documents, the same as my character does. The funny thing about this is that me and Chris would swap stories back and forth all the time. I actually read the first 50 pages of that novel, which didn't have that bit in it. That's towards the end of his novel. And I would show him my stories all the time, but I'd never shown him that story.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was really funny. It was a funny instance of hive mind, basically. Yeah. And I was like, maybe I should go back to that thing. But I was like, maybe I should give it a bit of time so it doesn't look like I'm copying Chris. But maybe I should go back to it. Maybe there was, you know, something in it. And I just kind of applied the things that I had learned in the time in between about basically cutting stuff. I remember I won, God, was it 2023 as well? I think I won a mentorship through the Northern Arts Council.
Nice.
And I got mentored by June Caldwell. I remember June just saying the most simplest sentences to me, but it just always stuck with me, where she was like, look, a short story is basically about somebody's there, something happens to them, they have changed. Just very basic.
Yeah.
And I realized then that so many of the short stories that I had written, which had failed to be published, actually didn't really do that. They were maybe like snapshots that actually probably would have fit into novels or something like that, you know, but they very rarely started with, right, here's X person, here's what's going on in their life, here's how this has changed them. And so, yeah, just kind of stripped it back, which is ironic given the ending.
Yeah. But was it much longer?
Good bit longer, yeah. Because I think it's about 5,000 words now. I think at the time it was 8 or 9.
Okay, and does she do any other jobs or...?
No, there was no other jobs. There was an annoying English, I guess what you would call, what they would call now, situationship. I don't know what we called it in 2020. I can't remember. I'm too old.
We definitely had some other name for it. But, I can't keep up.
But so it was something like that. Some like English lad calling over, being annoying, stuff like that. you know, class. Easy material to mine.
Like it's too easy.
But stuff like that. And then I think the bit with the mother was probably a bit longer as well. And then there was just more description. But again, that's what I'm going back to what I was saying. Like I had a habit of just like really overdoing it. And so, just kind of a lot of that cutting was going back and being like, okay, right, well, this is just, you know, putting a bit more dressing on top of something that didn't really need it. So just cut a lot of that out. And that's how it came about.
I think that something really works in this story is the impersonality of it. So I feel that if she had a situationship, like you said, it detracts from, I don't know, the, like you said, the mechanical kind of nature, the repetitiveness, the clipness of the prose, which I think just shows what she's doing. I think that really, it suits it much more than learn, like certain things are, stories particularly, they're really strengthened by what you take out, you know, rather than what you put in. Did you feel that in the editing process?
Yeah, no, I did. Like, I think that's why I decided to take that out, because I was like, the story here, again, is what these gig economy jobs are doing to this woman.
Yeah.
And I thought the brief phone call with the mother is enough of a tether to the real world that I was like, you're just hammering the point home rather than trying to be a bit subtle about it. With the fella calling over thing. I was just like, this doesn't accomplish anything that the brief phone call with the mother accomplishes. And yeah, in fact, it does detract from what you're doing, which is that, the story is, the heart of the story is that kind of dehumanization and feeling that dehumanization. And so having a personal relationship, even if it is a personal relationship that the character was pretty ambivalent about, it still, I think, doesn't really work, which is why it had to get out of there.
Yeah, no, definitely. And can I ask, not that you probably didn't need to, we all read so much about this stuff anyway, but did you read much about this kind of work or the gig economy or hear anecdotes or...
I don't really remember. It's hard to remember again because it was so long ago, but
yeah.
I do have this kind of idea in my head. Was it around the time that there was maybe some... Was it an attack on a delivery driver in Dublin?
I think there was.
I think that was around that time. Mm. I'm not 100% certain, but it certainly would have been. So if this was February, say, according to my laptop, maybe that winter or something like that. There were protests about that, about their safety and stuff like that, and about their status as workers and stuff. And so I did read stuff like that. Like I wouldn't say I did any huge deep dive into it or anything. I mean, I don't think you need to stand in a city street, it's pretty obvious within about 5 minutes what their conditions are like. Mm. I lived in San Francisco for a while as well.
Interesting. When?
2016 and 17.
Interesting.
Yeah. So,
what was it like?
It was, I mean, look, when you're a young Irish fella who plays hurling in San Francisco, there's no denying that it is like a good laugh.
Yeah, but, I did my J1 in San Francisco.
Yeah, I mean, it is a great city to have a good laugh in, but it's also a great city to lose a ton of money in and be faced with some of the most inhumane conditions known to the Western world, I would say.
I can imagine getting worse as well.
Yeah, I would imagine it's much worse now. Mm. Like, I haven't been back since I lived there, but I had seen Uber drivers, like, here, you know, it's funny, like the Just Eat and Deliveroo lads are kind of obviously have pretty bad conditions. But in Belfast, like Uber drivers tend to just be taxi drivers, like, you know, so it's a different kind of thing. Whereas like the Uber drivers in America were basically the same, working with the same conditions as those like delivery drivers and stuff, like where, like, you know, some of them were living in their cars and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. I'm sure that does happen in Ireland too, but it was much more apparent to the naked eye, say, in America. I think I just had that kind of stuff bubbling up in me for a long time of just seeing, I mean, being in the city that basically invented the gig economy and then seeing it reach places like Dublin. And now, at the time I wasn't living in Belfast, but now I'm in Belfast and I see it there too. And, you know, you also see people whenever they're in a city that doesn't have one of these things being like, oh, why can't we have this? And it's like, you really don't want this. Yeah. Like, it's awful. It, no matter how convenient it is, it's awful.
Yeah. Like, I feel something I find really interesting is because, you know, we didn't have Deliveroo, we didn't have Uber, and then suddenly we had them and it's just like everyone used them out of pure, like, we all lived without them, like, previously, so...
I know this is something that confuses me a lot about a lot of what some people might call technological advances. Yeah. I suppose is that I'm all for technological advances, but a lot of them are if not useless, outright retrograde. Like, I mean, yeah, like, yeah. People don't go, like, you, a lot of people just, like, barely leave their houses and stuff now, because, yeah. Like, and even, like, leaving your house to go pick up some takeout, like, is not exactly the most social of things.
I know, but it's still
least,
leaving.
It's at least forced interaction, yeah. Whereas opening your door and giving your man the code, like, is...
I know.
Totally, like, I don't know, it's crazy. And I'm not going to pretend that I don't do it sometimes, like, you know, but, like, the proliferation of it, yeah, and, like, how immediately everyone just kind of signed up to it, yeah. Like, is strange. And, yeah, kind of disheartening in a way, because you kind of, you see the reports from other places, you know, about how bad this stuff is,
yeah.
And then everyone's like, can't wait till that's here.
Yeah, better get here soon. I totally agree, and I think it's the convenience of it, but it's also, you know, in the convenience of it, has made, like, so much stuff, like, totally... And I think you really captured this story, like, pleasureless. Stuff that, like, was once pleasurable, like getting a takeaway or whatever, is now too convenient. I feel that way even about shopping and stuff. It's like there used to be a sort of joy to this that, like, the invention of an app has completely...
Yeah, my wife laughs at me. Like, I'd never go into a shop, like a clothes shop.
Yeah.
I have plenty of clothes,
yeah.
But she's just like you, like, you literally never go, you know, and, like, look around. I'm like,
yeah.
No. And, like, I should, you know, you catch yourself by surprise, you know,
yeah.
you'd find something that you like that you're never going to find otherwise or whatever like that. But, and you might actually, again, have to talk to someone, but, yeah, it's just, it is that really strange thing that, and yeah, I think it's really terrible, but it's also like, we talk about the convenience stuff. It's much more expensive. Like,
yeah.
If you order a Deliveroo or something,
yeah.
for one person,
yeah.
half the time in Belfast it'll get up to about £30.
Mm.
Like,
yeah,
just with delivery
know, yeah.
and all that stuff. So it's like, this isn't actually that convenient. It would probably have cost me less to ring someone,
yeah.
order and drive to their place wherever they're working out of. So yeah, I don't know, you're paying a premium for laziness and alienation.
Yeah. Oh yeah, you're paying for it. You're paying for alienation. Something I really, really liked in this story, and I think that you, like, we were kind of chatting about it there, is that just how sort of silent it is. Like, the loneliness is there, but it's not, like, totally apparent, as in, like, she's not being like, I'm very lonely doing all this work, but it's, she's not really talking to anyone. And she has those great two little interactions where the guy in the second job where she's shredding papers is like, you need a cushion, but the cushion never comes. And then when the guy at the bar offers them an after work drink, I've been here, and the drink never ever appears. Like, there's a sort of, like, there's such a meanness to the people that are employing her, and but it's coded in this sort of, like, veneer of friendliness.
Yeah, I've done some pretty menial jobs in my time, and I've been lucky enough that I haven't really come across people like that. But it was a very easy thing to imagine, you know, in the kind of situation that I'm putting these people in, that, like, you know yourself, like, office managers and, like, middle managers and stuff like that, you know, they're willing to wield both carrots and sticks.
Yeah.
And one of the things that they do love to do is to dangle a carrot, but then, you know, take it away. For no apparent reason whatsoever as well. I thought that was, I did make myself chuckle a few times with the thing of people being like, full payment all around as well, you know, as if that was a gift, as in, like, which of course gives the implication that the app has a mechanism by which you can take away someone's pay for bad performance.
And of course you get to review them, which is, like, the other really sinister side to all these apps. You're just constantly, like, reviewing each other back and forth.
Yeah, and maybe if they're even so bad, you can screenshot your review and post it on Twitter and get 30,000 people to tell them how terrible they are like that, you know? But I really wanted to get into that kind of wanton, pointless cruelty that a lot of people feel that they can basically exercise over people, but that especially things like these kinds of apps and this kind of precarity in, like, economic situations will allow people to do, you know, that if that precarity exists, I'm always doing you a favor, no matter how badly I'm treating you, no matter how badly I'm paying you, this has always been a favor to you, and, you know, maybe you might get a free drink at the end of it, but hopefully, your man even says it, hopefully you don't, because that would mean that we've gotten rid of all of our drink, you know? that's just the way I think a lot of these things, I think, because especially the last bit in the story, which is, like, upper class, London, I was like, it's not, I mean, all you have to do is turn on your TV. It's not difficult to imagine upper class Londoners there. What would you say, taking pleasure in other people's misery?
Yeah, yeah. I love the part where you mentioned Clive Owen, which is like very specific British actor to mention. Yeah. I forgot about Clive Owen and then I remembered.
I never forget about Clive Owen because...
He's always on my mind.
quite often, because like Children of Men is one of my favourite movies ever. Yeah, like, yeah. I also love Closer.
Yeah, great movie, yeah.
So... Yeah, Clive Owen. Whenever I was writing that, I was like, think of an English actor, and I was just like, Clive Owen, like, straight away. But yeah, no, he's always just stuck with me. He's very striking. I don't know, something
and he
is about
quintessentially
him,
like, English.
Yeah, he's really
in
English,
a way. Yeah.
Because I was like, who else is there? Your man who plays McNulty in The Wire, but then his most famous role is him doing an American accent.
Oh, yeah.
So I was like, no.
Is he Irish?
He's like Anglo-Irish kind of thing. Yeah. I think he might have... citizenship, but he's a Londoner, I think. Like,
yeah.
But I had probably just watched Children of Men again, but I think the Children of Men thing fits in with the obviously Children of Men and the story of two different visions of the future, but they're still, I think, complementary visions in the sense that they're about a future where everybody's, I don't know, ripping the backs off each other, like basically, you know, tearing each other's throats out. Literally in Children of Men and figuratively in this one, in the sense of, like, you know, it's a society that's been built that's not for the improvement of human life, shall we say.
Listen, that's right. But what you were saying there about the willingness for people to accept, you know, apps for the convenience of it, I feel like that has led so easily into AI, which is like people, like, that didn't exist really last year. People are like, oh, I can't live without ChatGPT or whatever. And these are people I know. They're like, they're like, I'll ChatGPT it and I'm looking at them murderously, but I don't think they're...
I know, it's like, it's all that thing of like doing things, using this stuff to do things that you've done in the past successfully, you know.
Yeah.
I'll use ChatGPT to write an email. It's like, what did you do last year?
Yeah.
Do you
know? Or your CV, or
It's like, what's wrong with your CV from last year? Why can't you just top that up? You
know?
I don't really get it again. Mm. Yeah, it's that thing where it's like, but also actually, from what I see again of like ChatGPT stuff, it's crap
terrible.
Like it is actually quite good at in my professional life. Like I work in like a PR company and ChatGPT is actually quite good at writing PR copy in the sense of like it's very easy to scrape, you know, LinkedIn and Business Insider and stuff like that and get the tenor of that stuff. But like to actually sound like a human is much more difficult because of the, I suppose, the differences between the different kinds of humans. Like, business speak is uniform, you know, and that kind of business promotional speak is especially uniform. Whereas like... You could scrape this thing and fly, and what you would come out with in AI would be crap because it would be like my story. Then there's also like two or three different languages in there, but like you get like my story, but then you get like what Sam Coyle wrote, or you get like what Oisin Fagan wrote, or whatever. And if you mix all those things together, you get something.
I don't even want to know
exactly. You get something just
some kind of
gibberish, like, you know, and people could probably, some idiot would probably say like, yeah, oh. Well, there's something in that idea or whatever. It's like you could triangulate some sort of Irish fiction or whatever.
Mm.
And it's just like, yeah, but A, who wants to do that? Yeah. Sounds terrible.
Yeah.
And B, I don't think it would work. I think it'd be crap. And yeah, I don't understand it. I don't really, well, I do understand it. People are lazy and looking for ways out of doing things. But I for all of the cost that comes with it in terms of how much electricity grid and stuff it takes up, like, is just to write the world's worst emails and the world's worst LinkedIn posts, which takes some doing to write the world's worst LinkedIn post. But it's just crazy to me.
I have been following very closely the AI bubble theory, using what I've learned from the TV show industry, which is not very much about the stock market. So I know almost nothing. But I'm like, maybe it won't happen. Maybe it is just all a massive lie. Can I ask, the kind of, you were saying living in San Francisco and even walking around Dublin and things, how much do you feel like the real world or what you're seeing in the world like influences your fiction?
A huge amount. basically, like, this story is actually kind of strange, I think, in my collection of stuff. Like, it's funny that this is the first, like I said, the thing that I did in Sonder was Flash. So this is the first proper short story I've had published. And so it is kind of funny that this is the one that gets published, because I don't actually think it's all that representative of the stuff that I write. And again, I wrote it so long ago as well. So like a lot of what I would do now, again, is quite like naturalistic, I would say. So it has to be based in like real world stuff. It's not always about cities and stuff. Like, I'm from the countryside and stuff. So I do like to write a lot of stuff about that kind of rural isolation rather than this kind of urban isolation that's in this one.
Yeah.
The ending of this is a bit fantastical in the sense where she starts peeling off her skin. And I think that this is actually, in the whole thing that I have, I think that is actually probably like the only non-realistic thing that I have like ever written. I did too, which is why I kept it in, because I was like, it's that unexpected thing, but it's also that I felt like it fit, and I felt like it was just the kind of, what would you say, like outwardly doing what you feel like doing. But obviously you can't really do it in real life, so it works on a page, but
or it's how you feel, you know, which is like, I love a ending based on feeling rather than
so that's what I wanted basically with that. But for the most part, in terms of my writing, like, yeah, it is 100% based basically in just kind of what I observe in the real world, because yeah, like I said, like that thing is a bit out of the ordinary for me, which I'm happy with. Like, I was happy to do it, and I was actually kind of a little bit surprised whenever Lisa emailed me about this one, because it was that little bit different from what I do. You know, you have that bit of trepidation that you maybe don't have about other things.
Yeah,
you know, you submit something or whatever, and you're like, yeah, this one's good or whatever. I was like, I think this is good, but I don't know if this ending comes off, you know, kind of thing, because it's just something totally unlike I've ever done. And it must have come off.
Yeah. Oh, no, it did. And do you do many drafts? Can I ask you just about your writing process? Like, what does that look like for you?
I suppose it differs, like, but this is something actually that's probably lost with people having laptops and stuff now. Yeah. It's definitely lost with me anyway, because I don't keep count of the drafts that I do.
Yeah.
I know I've seen some people will do it, you know, every new draft will start a new file, but like, that just seems like a lot of files to me. so I would be, my way of doing it is always, no matter how bad the first draft is, get the first draft done.
Yeah.
Just get it out, and that's when you can start actually like putting some shape on the thing, and overwrite if you need to and all that. Basically like just do whatever and just see what you're working with after that. Like, get the idea done. Because it is usually, I'll rarely have like the whole thing plotted out in my head. But what I will have is an idea of a kind of feeling that I'm trying to get at, and then maybe a couple of images. And then I'm like, right, how can I link those together into some sort of coherent narrative? And yeah, from there, so sometimes trying to link those things, you know, you end up writing a huge amount, other times you end up writing a couple of hundred words or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But then, yeah, that's when the real work starts or whatever, which is, again, I tried to go back to the basics of, right, what's the heart of this story? What is distracting from that heart, and what is contributing to it? What's repeated, whether that's words or images or, you know, same kind of point, basically. And just get them out, basically, because I've an awful tendency to be like, 10,000-12,000 words on first draft and stuff, which is very annoying. I've started getting a bit of a handle on it, thank God. But
it's difficult when you write long stories, because then you're like, where do I submit them?
Because even like somewhere like Sing and Fly doesn't have a limit, but like for them to print like a 10,000-word story, it needs to be like the dead, basically, you know, like it needs to be like that good, because you're going to take up like 40 pages of a 240 page magazine. So it's like, right, well, you better have written something pretty good here for us to take that bet on you. You know, and so but it's also like, one of the reasons why I used to write so long all the time was, I think, a basic misunderstanding of the form, which was like, you're writing a short story, you're not writing a short novel. You know, stop introducing a second story thread and stuff like that. It's like, that's not what this is for. If you want to do that, write a novel.
I totally agree. And I think that takes a little while to learn as well. You know, like I feel that something with a short story is you have to sit down and look at it and be like, do I need every single part of this? Like, what can I take out? Like, what can I hint at that will still make it, you know, strong rather than putting everything in? If you do want to do that, yeah, just write a novel that can contain all that, you know?
Yeah. And as well, it's that finding the difference between like a normal plot and like, obviously a very common device in a short story is like someone having some sort of crisis that isn't the real crisis, you know, that is indicative of what's going on mentally or emotionally or whatever. And it's figuring out, okay, what is that? So that can stay in. Mm-hmm. And what is like the B plot that you have introduced for no reason, you know? And how do you separate all those things from each other and make sure that the story isn't just a story, a straightforward story of someone having a bad time or whatever, or a good time.
There are so few of those.
There aren't many of those, yeah.
Particularly in the Irish short story. We don't specialize in those.
Yeah. I mean, what's a good time story going to do? You're just going to start.
I know. Like, they were happy.
Yeah. And at the end, they were happy again. You know.
They were happier. So there's a slight change.
I mean, you could do that. Like, yeah. But I don't know. Don't ask me how to do it. But yeah, but no, it's, so yeah, it's that kind of complicated, I suppose, thing of figuring that out. And yeah, like, see, the thing was with me, like I have never gone through any, formal literary education. I've a journalism degree and a non-fiction degree. But never did anything in terms of fiction. The closest I ever got was whenever I was doing my master's, I had an elective where, what was it called? Ludic literature.
Oh.
Where we used to study Joyce, Kafka, Dostoevsky, and what's the other Russian? The guy who wrote Lolita.
Oh, Nabokov.
Nabokov, yes. So we did like Pale Fire and stuff, which actually was great. And it was actually the thing that kind of started me on understanding short stories and stuff like that, because Joyce, we did Dubliners, and then we actually did Dubliners 100 as well.
Dubliners is such a good book. I know it's people amazing, like, say that, but it is.
I felt so cliche whenever I actually hadn't read Joyce. I was only like 21 or whatever, and I hadn't read Joyce, and I was like, so they made us get Dubliners and Dubliners 100 for this class, and I was just reading Dubliners and I was like, classic, like, Irish lad moves abroad, reads Joyce, and is like, wow, this is great. Like,
no, but it's,
but it's
great.
What can you do? Like, I mean, it really is, like, it's just, there's a reason why, you know, he's still talked about, why those stories are still talked about like 100 and something years later. Like,
that's so true. And you did your an MA in nonfiction, and was that at UEA?
Yes.
Like, yeah. Nice. And how did you find that? Like, what was the process of that? And then from going to nonfiction to writing fiction?
I enjoyed it like massively at the time, and like I thought the nonfiction thing would have suited me better because I had a degree in journalism, basically, and was trying to kind of go down this route of like, when I look back on it now, like, it's kind of cringy or whatever, but like trying to go down this route of like figuring out of like writing basically like nonfiction about kind of my generation of, say, like young rural Irish lads, and like basically trying to figure out what was wrong with us.
Good luck.
Yeah. So I gave
that is not
gave
a one person job.
I gave that up. It was too hard a job. Yeah. But no, like I really enjoyed it, and I enjoyed the year, and I enjoyed putting my thesis together and all that. UEA is a great university.
It's a great course.
Yeah, and it afforded me that opportunity to sit in on the Ludic literature thing, which was great. But as I finished, and as like nonfiction was like gathering pace. It sounds strange to say about something so generalized as nonfiction, but like, you know, like there has been like a big uptick in creative nonfiction.
Yes, definitely.
The last decade, probably a bit more at this rate. But the thing that I was starting to kind of get sick of with it was I found that a lot of it was about people's own lives. If you get me right.
Like, no, I totally understand, yeah.
But like, but also like about their illness or their parents' illness or something like that. And I just, the more I thought about it, the more I got I suppose, educated or something, like in outside of college and stuff, like educated in just being kind of, what would you say, sensitive to other people's thought and feelings. I was kind of like, I don't really want to mine and my family's and my friends' personal lives for what is essentially content, right? It's literature, so it's a bit of an elevated content, but like say, like obviously you get paid to write this thing and fly. Do I want to sell the story of, let's say, my grandmother had Alzheimer's? Do I want to sell that story? Not really, to be honest. Like I don't want to talk about these things in the sense of turning them into a commodity, if you get me. And I'm not insulting the people who do it or anything like that, but I just felt personally uncomfortable with it. But I enjoyed writing. And so I was like, I want to keep writing, but I guess I'm just going to make things up from now on. And so I just turned to fiction.
Also, you get then, you know, you can still write about things that happen to you and things that you're thinking about, but you get to be like, it's fiction.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. And there's a freedom to it. Like there's a total freedom to it that there isn't in nonfiction. Mm-hmm. But there's also, yeah, that deniability.
Yeah,
I mean, like, even if someone that knows you is like, that's exactly what happened to you, you're like, no, it's not.
And if you add that little element of like strangeness, it is amazing how people will immediately just be like, well, that's fiction.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's also like, if you add the element of, if you gender swap your character, nobody would ever say to me that that character in that story is me. Yeah, and it might well have been. It isn't, because I never lived in London and I didn't do those jobs. But it might well have been where, if I had written a story about a fellow working on building sites or something like that, people would be like, oh, did you work on the sites? Did you know, kind of thing. And yeah, so there's a distance that you can put between it, like, which is, I think, what I want. Other people can want different things and stuff like that. And so, like, if you're comfortable with kind of putting your family or yourself, your own history out there and all that, you know, best of luck to you. Like, I don't want to do it. Like, I very much follow that kind of pinch on McCarthy line of, you don't need to know things about me.
Yeah. You know? And I think there is like a certain, you know, I kind of have this, there's a lot of autofiction and like memoir out there at the moment. And it does involve like sometimes even, you know, something I noticed recently reading the reviews of the new Patricia Lockwood book of a writer that you know a lot about. Mm. There is something then you're almost out there like as a character yourself and everything that is in your history. Yeah. It's in the review. Yeah. So there's actually a real power from withholding.
Yes, 100%. You know? I just totally agree. Like, I think too often, and it's kind of probably unavoidable now with, I don't know how publishers are, I don't have one. But like with the way things are in terms of like having to promote and things like that, so that it's probably inevitable that there'll be, you know, you'll never have like a, again, like use Pynchon as an example. Mm. You never have something like that again where people just know nothing about you. Unless you do it under a pseudonym like Elena Ferrant or Leila Nikine or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I think people who are writing fiction anyway should definitely, I think, try their best to limit the amount of information about them out there, because it does just become part of your work, even though like you could write something totally different. Mm-hmm. You know, you could be writing something that is just completely unrelated. Mm. Like you'd be writing, like say, like Oisin Fagan's last novel, Nobber. Mm. Like you could be writing something set in the Black Plague and people would still be, you know, trying to inject your personal life story into it. Like, you know.
Which is ridiculous. I do think that so much autofiction has led critics to only be able to read stuff on an autofictional level, which is just
100%. And like, that's not to say, like, there's some fiction, quote unquote fiction, or whatever you call it, like autofiction or whatever, but that is very clearly very autobiographical that I think is brilliant. Like I think Michael McGee's book is one of the best books to come out of Ireland in a long time. Like, and he would make no bones about the fact that is heavily based on his own life. Mm. But then because the character's called Sean or Michael and it is stocked in the fiction shelves, he still does have a bit of distance from it. And he has never, to my knowledge anyway, and I've listened to a few interviews with him, he has never been like, oh yeah, this happened, this didn't happen. Which, you know, I think is the right approach. If you're going to do that kind of thing, you know, just say, yeah, look, there's the book, and don't really get into how much is autobiographical or how much isn't.
Yeah, but the success of that book is also dependent on the fact that it's, you know, very well written. It's a piece of craft as well.
Yeah, exactly.
As like, it's not like he just wrote, you know, all about himself and expected us to, it's been worked on, you know, and I think that is something that also has to be explored.
I mean, that's the thing, that is the main thing at the end of the day, is like the question should always be, is this a good book or not?
Yeah.
You know, is the story good or not?
Yeah.
You know, but that is why I think you're at your best in those terms to limit the amount of things that people know about you, because if you're going to be like a public facing figure, because quite often when you see discussions of famous authors, the discussion, even when they put out a new book, the discussion is not about the book. The discussion is about the person and how this new book might add to their mystique or whatever it is.
Or their brand.
Yeah. Even again, use Pynchon. Find me a novel, find me a review of the new novel that doesn't mention that he's like a hermit, basically. I suppose you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, kind of thing, in that sense, because everyone just talks about how he's a recluse and all this kind of stuff, but it's like, no, he's probably just a normal man.
you just don't know who
Don't know what he looks like, he could walk in the street and you don't know.
There is all this, like, you know, this baggage that comes with being a figure now, and I've also noticed it in the, obviously, you know, she was and she emerged, but the reviews of the new Zadie Smith essay collection.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And it comes from, like, you know, her being in the public eye, being a semi-celebrity, that these things cannot be assessed on their merit, like, on, and how the actual essay looks or reads or, anyway. Can you tell me about your influences, particularly story writers or any?
Yeah.
And feel free to be broad.
Yeah. So it is a broad thing, like, because I remember being in UEA and someone in my class came up to me and gave me this thing. It was like a Guardian lit supplement handout of, like, one of these classic, the new class of Irish fiction, you know. But this was like 2015, so this is when this latest wave that I think is still going on, basically.
They never stop. It's wave after wave.
Yeah, but this is the beginning of this particular wave, I think. So it was stuff like Colin Barrett and stuff like that, you know. And so from there, I went through an awful period whenever I was probably like 18 to 20 of barely reading. Just doing all, going to college, I guess. But had obviously whenever I was over in Norwich and stuff, was reading a good bit and stuff, but like, was reading mostly for the course and stuff. And so then whenever that woman handed me that thing, I was like looking at these names and stuff like Colin Barrett or whatever. And I was like, right, God. And I remember just picking up Young Skins and just being like bowled over, basically. And that's sticking with me basically forever. Well, it's been a while, like 10 years. That has just stuck with me. I think he is, I don't want to start ranking people or anything like that, but he's like up there with like the best of the, certainly the Irish.
I think we should rank them. Let's go now.
100%, yeah.
5-1.
So he has stuck with me, like, and his second thing of stories is brilliant as well. Like the one, the 10, I actually said it in the night of this launch. I was like, the 10 was something else.
Is that the GA player one?
The football soccer player. Yeah.
That's good.
So yeah, there was that. Then, in terms of like the modern short story writers and stuff, Adrian Duncan as well, his collection. I actually remember reading Prozanecki in The Stinging Fly. I still remember the first time reading it. I was waiting for a haircut in Merrifield in Derry. Just sitting there and being like, God, I hope they don't call me here because I want to finish the story. That one was like, I think Adrian is like, I don't think he gets half enough attention for how good he is. He's able to do things in fiction that I think are very rare, which is like, he like imbues just like everyday objects with this kind of importance that's really strange. Like, it, you can see the engineer in him coming out, you know, and all that kind of stuff.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, it is, because I was terrible at any kind of engineering or tech graphics or any of that kind of stuff in school and stuff, like, so I would never brain like that at all. But then when you can see it like working, and you can see his engineering brain working even when he's talking about something like soccer, like in Prozanecki.
Mike McCormick, another writer with an engineering degree.
You can see it in his as well. These things always come out, like whatever someone's other interests are outside of literature, they always just come through, even when they're not talking about them. These things like shape or whatever. Then outside of Ireland, I like I'm very cautious about reading any modern stuff that's outside of Ireland because honestly, I just don't like a lot of it. But
do you want to name names? Or?
No, we'll be here for a while. But one
I'm pushing the podcast into. I want us to get sued. No.
whenever I say outside of Ireland, actually, what I actually just mean is America. Like, yeah. I think a lot of American fiction is like really bad at the minute.
What do you think is making it bad?
Most of the people who write it, and I mean this in the nicest sense possible, are not particularly normal. Mm. And I don't mean that in any, like, I don't mean it in like a prescriptive sense of like, there is this normal and you have to be that. I mean, they go into English degrees at 18, mm-hmm. they go into MFA degrees at 21, and by the time they are publishing their stories, the only people they've ever spoken to are people who are exactly like them.
I think that's a real problem.
Yeah. And so... Every one of their characters talks like them, thinks like them, thinks within the kind of circular degrees to which they are not permitted to think. That's a bit that's overly harsh. Like, but you know, they typically present in these circles, and they become they do an MFA, they become MFA directors, and they live like I've seen it. I've been in American academics' houses in Orange, California, where they live next door to another academic or whatever, you know. And it's just like, I mean, look, it's a living and all that, but like, it's a what would you say? It's a closed atmosphere, where you are not encountering real life enough. Mm. I don't think, especially in America, because of the way their universities are built, which is typically, you know, these gigantic campuses. And then their staff or their postgrads or whatever get put into housing, which isn't on campus, but is all beside just more staff and postgrads. So you end up just only knowing people like you. And
that's always bad, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And then your books just become about people like you.
And they also sometimes, you know, they feel like they're giving out to you.
There's the annoying moralizing of a lot of
It feels like a monologue where someone's like chastising you.
Yeah.
I'm like, I don't know. If I wanted this, I'd call my mother. Like, it's sort of just, you know. Yeah.
And there's the thing of, I think the MFAs are probably to blame for this, but there's the thing of, a lot of people seem to think, and this isn't exclusive to fiction, but a lot of people seem to think that portraying something is endorsing it, which it obviously is not, you know. And so there's a lack of like bastards in fiction, like proper bad characters in fiction stories these days, I think a lot of the time, because people are kind of trained now not to do it. Like, you know, everyone has to be like having nuance to your character is obviously not a bad thing, but like everyone has to be a bit scaled back, you know, like if you're a properly bad character, like it's rare enough now, which like, I mean, look at, say, like, again, I keep going back to Pynchon, for God's sake, but like, look at One Bad Left or Another, where it came out there, like Steve, like there's nothing redeeming about Steve Lockjaw.
I think so too. I'm like, I don't even want ambivalent. Like, I don't even want ambivalence anymore. I want someone to be like bad.
Yeah.
Because at least then they will have like a sort of camp. Like I saw, speaking of academics, that after The Hunt, that new Ganina, absolutely terrible. But it did have that sort of thing where I was like, I think this would have worked better if you weren't trying to show the shades of grey.
Yeah.
If one or two of these people were just irredeemable, you know?
It works. Like everything can work. Any approach can work depending on what kind of story you're trying to tell. But like, I think there's too much of that kind of softly stories that honestly have no stakes to them either. Mm. Like, so much for so boring. Mm. But sorry, the reason I actually started saying this was because I was going to say that I actually really like Jemele Brinkley.
Oh, yes. I actually haven't read his book. I've heard great things.
I really enjoy his two collections. Mm. So yeah, just because I think he's exactly the opposite of everything I've just said.
Mm.
His characters are varied, normal people.
Mm.
Which shows that you can do an MFA and teach on an MFA and still retain some normalcy if you make the effort.
Mm.
I really enjoy his work. And then I suppose the other influences then, you're going back in the past, like any young rural Irish man, I have to love John McGarren, which is just...
We need to, like, I think I'm going to, you know... add up all the mentions of the people on the podcast, and I think like Colin's going to rank very highly, and then McGarren will be maybe below Colin, but in the top.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Colin's probably just the McGarren for people my age. Whereas, yeah,
without the others.
You can see like Colin obviously has that. What would I say? Like a wider vocabulary and stuff. And like obviously done on purpose, you know, that kind of more, especially in the first book, I think is more kind of like, it's nearly like gothic with the amount of like, with the type of language that he uses and stuff. But in terms of feel and then in terms of what's going on, a lot, they remind me of each other a lot, except for the fact, obviously, that McGarren like constantly repeats himself, which a much worse writer would not get away with. But he can get away with it. Then other than that, I do go back to the Americans from the kind of mid-century, people like Faulkner and stuff. I think Faulkner was very, what would you say, applicable to rural Ireland as well.
Yeah.
I think he's actually, I've been thinking about this more and more as I've lived in the North for so long. I think he's like really applicable to the North as well, in the sense of like these like ex-Confederates dealing with the fall of the social order in the South. Of the South of America is it's very analogous to, I think, kind of like unionism and stuff. It's an interesting kind of thing. You know, like I remember I was driving through Derry somewhere and I saw like an old orange hall like falling apart, and I was like, that's like the beginning of a Faulkner novel there. Somebody trying to get that on the go again, kind of thing.
Right, two last questions because we're going over time. First one is, what did you think of the new Pynchon novel? Have you read it?
I haven't read it. Okay. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. I haven't read it yet either. And any other piece in this issue that you'd like to recommend?
Yes. It was, the one that has stuck with me the most was The Clearing by Sinead McGuinness.
Oh, yes.
All that slagging I've just done of people writing about their families. Non-fiction.
I mean, there's exceptions to the rule. That's why families, it's, yeah.
But I am, of The Clearing, even the title, like, it's really evocative once you understand that Sinead is Scottish, because of the Highland clearances and stuff, and she's talking about her grandfather who came from the islands. And I just, it's the kind of thing that is interesting to me as well. Like, I was raised speaking Irish, so the kind of question of how do we, as like people who are involved in like any kind of Gaelic culture, whether that's the language or like Ireland or for them, Shinty in their language, how do you keep it alive rather than making it some sort of museum piece where we can say, Jesus, isn't it great that, you know, that was there or whatever. And, you know, I think a lot of people in Ireland are really guilty of like imbuing Irish with like some sort of like magical quality. When you kind of just want to be like, no, like, this is just how I talk to my father, you know. But, and so I thought that was really interesting about Sinead's grandfather, like literally having all of this stuff just like confined to a room in the house. And I was like, yeah, that's exactly the opposite approach that I would like to take, you know? I don't know who Sinead's grandfather is. She does say that he was like an academic or like a leading source of like Gaelic, like in academia, I think, basically. And so obviously, of course, I'm sure he lived it too. Like, but in those examples that she gives, you're like, oh God, that's my literal worst fear. about these things. Like, when I see, like, say, like my brother talking Irish to my niece, I'm like, yeah, that's the good example here. Mm. And then the stuff literally being locked away in a room where it's like, yeah, we used to do it or whatever, but we don't anymore. It stuck with me a lot. Like, I go on this trip every year, a hurling versus shinty trip between Scotland and Ulster. And it's like the Scottish team are all lads who speak Gaelic and we're all lads who speak Irish.
Oh, that's super
interesting. So it's like an interesting exchange and stuff. Yeah. And so it's helped me like appreciate how similar a lot of that stuff is, you know, how tied in we are with that kind of stuff. But then even just reading the bit where she talks about her grandmother being taken to a boarding school off of her island when she was like four, and then she loses her Gaelic because of that. It reminded me of you know, you hear the stories of the like First Nations in Canada or in America where they were put into boarding schools as well, typically run by the Catholic Church or whatever. Now, in Scotland, that wouldn't have been Catholic Church, but and they all lost their languages through doing that as well. And it just reminded, it's that kind of reminder of like, right, we're not all the same in the sense that we don't all experience the exact same thing. And, you know, there's no point in like trying to pretend that we do experience the exact same thing, but we do experience things that are quite similar, basically all over the world. Especially in those kinds of senses of that kind of like minority language or minority language communities and stuff like that. People who were like in the terms of people like Sinead's grandfather were literally cleared off the land for I suppose the British colonial project. And again, those like First Nations people who were cleared off the land for the Canadian and American colonial projects. Here, a lot of the clearing off the land was done by Irish people. So you can't say it was done by a colonial project, but it's a lot of it, we didn't get sent to, well, I say we as if I was there. Mm. But those people didn't get sent to boarding schools and stuff like that. They just didn't get educated for the most part. And then whenever the 19th century came around, they had to get educated through English. So again, it functioned, state education functioned as language loss. And so these are things that are like important to me and stick in my head. And so then whenever I read that thing from Sinead, it just very much chimed with me and stuck with me of, again, kind of reinforcing, like that Shinty and Hurling trip does every year, reinforcing to me that like the people in the Highlands and the Islands in Scotland are very, very similar to, say, like the kind of people that we would have in Donegal and Galway and Kerry. And still dealing with the same thing and still dealing with the fact that, you know, most of their families have spread to the other ends of the world because of that. And yeah, I thought it was a really good piece. And I thought it was actually really good in the sense that it never tried to answer that. It's just kind of, this is what we deal with, like Sinead herself, as she says, and the thing is in London. Like, and her grandfather was in Edinburgh, much like most of the people from Donegal. it was very, very interesting to me in that sense that our journeys tend to rhyme a lot, the Scots, the Irish people, and even the natives in America. Now, I'm never going to say that what happened here was anywhere near the slaughter that was done to the natives in America, but it's the cultural experience is still quite the same, I think, in that marginalization sense.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. And thank you for your story. That was great. Thank you for listening to the Stinging Fly podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please share it. Or if you're new to the podcast, please subscribe. You can support the work we do by taking out a subscription to the Stinging Fly magazine or by becoming a friend of the fly. Information, all our workshops, events and publications can be found on stingingfly.org. The Stinging Fly podcast is hosted by me, Nicole Flattery, produced by Owen Rogers and edited by Ian Lane.